It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The public outcry over the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, two black men at the hands of white police officers, continues to spark protests around the country. One of the many legal aspects being called into question in these instances is the role of local prosecutors taking the cases to grand juries. New York State is now among those asking the question, should local prosecutors prosecute local cops? Joining us now to explore this question is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. David, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Well, thank you. In the wake of the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner at the hands of police officers, many have voiced a lack of confidence in local prosecutors who have often failed to charge police with any criminal conduct. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a feeling, accurate or not, that local prosecutors and police are sort of joined at the hip, that this isn't quite the police judging themselves, but it's pretty close. Let me explain. Local prosecutors, of course, are elected officials in almost every state. They are elected county by county, and every day they work with police officers and the police departments in their jurisdictions. So when they are asked to step in and investigate and to consider charges, as they normally would, many people feel that there is a conflict of interest there of one kind or another, that police and prosecutors are sort of on the same team. And I can tell you that that's true, having been a prosecutor sort of briefly myself. You're on the law enforcement team. And so many citizens are asking, in the wake of these cases in which charges were not brought, be it a grand jury presentation or not, they wonder if local prosecutors are far enough away, are independent of the police to enough of a degree that a fair judgment is being made.
So you're saying that they work with these cops every day, the special prosecutors do. I should say the district attorneys do and the local prosecutors, that they are with them, working with cops every day to put criminals away, and that it is then difficult for them to turn around and prosecute police officers.
It may be. Now, we should note, for instance, in our own county, that our district attorney has prosecuted police officers in the past. So it isn't as if this never happens. But the question is a fair judgment possible when you are judging people who are on the same team, essentially, that you are? And it may be that a fair call is made in every single case by the district attorney's office. That is good, but even if it's true, people have a question about the appearance of impartiality, whether it's there or not. Is there some kind of a willingness to judge police officers differently than other members of the public would be judged? And that has got people talking for the first time about bringing in some kind of an independent prosecutor or a special prosecutor specifically for cases involving deaths in police custody, those kind of cases. And I think it is a partial answer. It's not a full answer to some of these questions, but it's certainly worth considering. And that's why the Attorney General of New York is now making noises about doing this himself instead of local prosecutors.
Right. This has come up in New York.
Yes.
Had it been brought up before?
In various contexts, yes. And in Wisconsin earlier this year, a law passed the Wisconsin legislature that did make these kinds of changes to a certain degree, not the full degree. It mandates an independent review board for every police shooting case, a critical incident review board to do the investigation that is not made up of local police. It does not mandate that a prosecutor who is not local make the judgment of whether or not to prosecute. So it sort of takes it halfway, just as does the investigation, but doesn't participate in the decision whether or not to prosecute or prosecute the case. There are some other flaws in the Wisconsin law. Those who supported it seem to think it was just the sort of half a loaf thing. It's better than nothing. But there are many others who were pulling for a law like this who aren't really satisfied with it. So the Wisconsin law is a good start. There's also a law like this in Ontario, Canada. They created an independent unit for Ontario that whenever there is a death in police custody, comes in, does the full investigation, and decides whether to prosecute and takes the case forward. That does address this issue of whether or not the prosecutor is independent enough in any particular case involving police.
But as far as these review boards, who sits on the review board? Who are the impartial people?
Well, that's exactly one of the problems with the Wisconsin law. The way it's set up there, there are two police officials, a couple of attorneys and so forth, but it never says who the police officials can be, who would be sufficiently impartial to sit on the review board. So that's an issue there. When you're setting these things up, if you're going to go to the trouble of passing a law or setting up an arrangement like this, you don't want those new legislative creatures to be questioned in their impartiality. You might as well do the whole job. Like I said, this takes care of part of the problem, but it's not the only reason that sometimes police don't get charged. So we should not be under the illusion that this would solve the whole problem.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris about the idea, as has been suggested, in New York State, about whether local prosecutors should prosecute local cops, and is it a better idea to bring in special prosecutors or review boards to handle these cases. What are your thoughts? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Do you think that there are better ways to handle the investigations and the grand jury hearings of police involved in the shootings of, as in the case of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, unarmed men? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And David, when we look at this and consider what New York State is suggesting, that there are other ways to do this, that we should eliminate the local prosecutors, if you spin the prism here a little bit, isn't there a failure to bring charges against police on the part of the grand juries? Shouldn't they be held more accountable here? Do they share the blame? You know, if blame should be assigned in the cases of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, is it just the prosecutors that should shoulder the criticism, or are the grand juries at fault themselves, or the system?
I think it's the system, Paul. I don't think it's the grand juries that are at fault. As we've said before on your program, grand juries are run by the prosecutors. Despite some rhetoric that tells you that they're very independent and they do what they want, they do what prosecutors allow them to do. They act on the evidence that prosecutors put before them. They vote on the charges that prosecutors propose and the indictments that prosecutors draft. So I don't think they're to blame. And in fact, there is no constitutional right to have a grand jury in the states. It is in the Federal Bill of Rights, but it was never made effective as against the states. So the states could get rid of the grand jury altogether if they wanted. You really have two levels of problems here. Number one is this problem of impartiality or the appearance of impartiality. And that the independent prosecutor idea would addressed to some degree. The other is that this is a larger problem than just who prosecutes. The law, as it is laid out, with the allowance of the police to use reasonable force as the situation appears, that's a very open-ended and flexible standard. And that, as much as anything else, is responsible for whether or not police officers are charged, and when they are charged, whether they're convicted. I was in a meeting last week with a very prominent prosecutor in this community, somebody who'd served at the state level, and he called our attention when this subject came up. He called our attention to the fact that that certain police officers had been prosecuted 2 and 3 times on sets of charges, and they just can't convict. The public gives them the benefit of the doubt. The police have the privilege to use force, and it's all judged under the sort of reasonableness standard. So it's not just a problem of impartiality. That's part of it. It's also the underlying law itself that makes it hard to charge and then hard to convict.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Let's go to Nancy in Pittsburgh. Nancy, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you for the show today. I've been participating in a lot of the recent rallies and events in the community to join Pittsburgh in the national conversation on these issues, and I appreciate a lot of the dimensions you're bringing up, especially that a special prosecutor, how much of a priority that is, but also that it's definitely only one facet of the story. And I'm interested in maybe if you can speak a little bit about some of the local cases, like Leon Ford, and also, you know, kind of continuing some of these other dimensions, like the FOP and how the Union for Police has gotten involved. And even when you spoke about some of the laws that are interfering with these processes, maybe looking at that conversation a little further in terms of how they're allowed to use lethal force so readily. So, but especially Leon Ford, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that case.
Certainly, Nancy. The Leon Ford case, as many people probably know, involved a gentleman who was stopped in the Highland Park area, showed his license, registration, other documents, everything checked out. But there was a horrible outcome when an officer jumped in the car as it was accelerating away, and Mr. Ford was shot multiple times and ended up a paraplegic. He was acquitted in a trial of Mr. Ford. He was acquitted. And now there is an investigation, I understand, pending, an investigation of one, at least one of those police officers. And the district attorney's office is now considering whether to drop the remaining charges against Mr. Ford, which the jury could not agree on. I think there's a lot of pressure coming from the community being directed at the DA's office. I've been witness to some of it. They would like to see the remaining charges drop, but that is entirely the DA's call, and I'm certain that there will be a decision on that sometime, I hope in the near future, because it would be good for everybody to know what is going on and for this to be resolved for the community's sake, if not for police sake.
Before you move on to your next point here, how does a prosecutor, how do you legitimize the remaining charges for someone like Leon Ford, especially when the man for whom he was mistaken for did emerge and the police tried to apprehend him just last week. He died fleeing the police. So here's Leon Ford, who was asked to provide the proof that he was not the person the police thought he was and did, and then reacted. I'll use the term, might have freaked out a little bit, as most of us would in a situation where what else can you do to prove who you are other than hand your license over to the police, which Leon Ford did?
Yes, this was a terrible situation. I've watched the video, as I know probably many members of the public have here in Pittsburgh, and I think it raises very substantial questions. The issue for Mr. Zappala, our DA, at this point is going to be this. He knows that the jury has already disagreed on whether or not Mr. Ford is guilty. They have found him not guilty of the top and most serious charge that he had put on him. So in a situation like that, and then you have a jury not being able to come to a guilty verdict or a verdict of innocent on the remaining charges, that leaves a prosecutor thinking, I don't even know whether I can prove the rest of it since we couldn't prove the most serious thing. That's the thought process that goes on there. As far as the facts, very, very difficult case. The video, I think, is a big part of that case, and I think that will swing a lot of the opinion on what they ultimately decide to do. This has not been an easy case for Pittsburgh. It's certainly been a terrible ordeal for Mr. Ford and for everybody involved, so I hope that they will come to a decision soon. On the very last issue that Nancy raised, the use of lethal force, as I know we've discussed at different times on your show, Paul, police are allowed to use only the amount of force that is necessary and proportional in the situation that is presented to them. Now, they have the privilege to use force in a way that civilians do not, but they have the obligation to make sure that that force is proportional. That's the judgment any jury makes in a case, whether it is a criminal case against a police officer or later a civil suit against a police officer and the city. The fact is that these are hard cases to win against police in the jury setting. That's just the reality of it. We've gone into many of the reasons for that on many of your shows before. But that's the reality that prosecutors deal with. And their charge as prosecutors is they're not supposed to bring cases that they don't think they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That question is getting a really good working over in the Leon Ford matter.
Let's go to Rome in Pittsburgh. Rome, welcome to the show. How are you?
How you doing today?
Good, sir.
Okay, made some very good points on there. And on the last point he mentioned about let's look at the reality of things. I think one of the crucial points that is missing is the racism involved here. The systematic system, the way it's set up, the grand jury, the way they're selected, and the people involved in it overall. Think about this. Take the Leon Ford case, the Michael Brown case. What would have happened if they would have put 12 African-American men and women on there? Do you think that the district attorney could have swayed them one way or another? Or some young people on there, they pick the people they know they're going to go with the police. You pick 12 white women, they love the police. Police are infallible. And the way the laws are written makes them infallible no matter what they do. And then all you have to do is listen to them on TV. If you would just do what we say, really, the gentleman in Walmart did what he said. He got shot. The gentleman in Ohio reaching for his wallet, police instruction, he got shot. Michael Brown fleeing or whatever, he got shot. So no matter what you end up doing, you end up getting shot.
This is a very interesting and important question that the caller is raising. The jurors, be they grand jurors or members of a petty jury, they are given instructions to follow the law and make the judgment about the facts. That is all that they are told to do and, frankly, all that they can do. How they are selected, they are supposed to be selected off a list that will give you a cross-section of the community. Sometimes that ends up with proportional representation on any given jury or grand jury, a proportional representation of the community. Sometimes not, but overall, it's supposed to be a cross-section of the community. Jurors do bring their life experience to the judgments that they make. That is my experience with them anyway. And I would have to disagree with the gentleman when he says that 12 white women would decide this way, maybe 12 black women another way. I don't think you can break it down that clearly or neatly. I think people are the product of their beliefs and their experiences. And when we have people on juries that represent the community and we have clear claims on that, what we'll have is a representation of the community's sentiment on these issues. It's not a perfect system by any means, and I would not defend every aspect of it. Not every country does this, but that's how we do it.
When it comes to overhauling the system, and it's under scrutiny, and it should be, are there other changes that are necessary other than the suggestion that we go to a special prosecutor instead of a local prosecutor, that we maybe throw out the idea of having a grand jury handle this altogether? What do you think, David, needs to be put on the list?
Well, other than the possibility of independent prosecution and investigation, which are two worthy ideas, I think we should actually start thinking about whether the law as it's set up with that reasonableness standard, whether that is adequate to the realities that we face. The last caller brought up some very interesting and powerful points when he says he sees these judgments always going the same way. We don't want our police to ignore our problems. We want them to come into our communities when we call them. We want them to take action that is necessary, but we don't want them to overreact. So that points us not only to the law, but it also points us to aspects of police training, discipline, and accountability. I heard a very interesting interview with somebody on National Public Radio about a week ago named Eric Adams. He's a former police officer and president of the borough of Brooklyn now. Yeah. He said police have a whole toolbox of ways that they can do things. They have de-escalation training. They have training in less than lethal weapons. And he said, my fear, and he's an African-American gentleman, he said, my fear is that only one set of tools gets used in communities of color. Not all the tools get used. Therefore, you have Eric Garner dying for selling loose cigarettes. People want police to come into their community and restore order. Maybe it's loose cigarettes or panhandling or something else. But we want the force of the police to be governed in ways and used in ways that are even-handed and no greater than is necessary to do their very difficult and dangerous job.
And some of this may – some of the issues here and the questions that come up may stem from the way that police are trained. Tomorrow on this program, we're having a discussion with former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams, who is now a member of the Citizens Police Review Board. He will be joining us to address some of the issues from a former cop's point of view, and it should be a very interesting discussion.
I'd urge everybody to tune in. Sheldon is a fount of wisdom on these things.
There's one last thing I wanted to cover before we wrap this up, and it's somewhat related, somewhat unrelated. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday ruled that police officers do not necessarily violate a person's constitutional rights when they stop a car based on a mistaken understanding of the law. And this stems from a situation in which a policeman in a state which did not require an automobile, a driver to be pulled over if they had a taillight out, as many states do, this policeman, for whatever reason, wasn't aware that he was not required to pull this motorist over. The ruling prompted a lone dissent from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who warned that the court's decision could exacerbate public suspicion of police in some communities. What can be said about this ruling and future precedents, David?
Well, it's a very interesting ruling, Paul, because the police have for years already had the power to make a traffic stop based on observing any traffic offense at all. That's full probable cause for a stop. Here you had what the police officer thought was a traffic offense. He pulls the car over. That leads to a consent search, and that leads to discovery of some drugs, and the person is charged with a drug crime. And what we know now is that, of course, the police officer was wrong. There was no such law and no such offense in his state. And what the Supreme Court has essentially said is, yes, you can pull over people for any traffic offense, and even for traffic offenses that don't exist, as long as the police officer reasonably thought they did. Now, what I can't get my arms
around.
How
is it reasonable if
exactly? Right, how is it reasonable if you're trying to if you're a police officer, you're enforcing the traffic laws day to day? How's it reasonable to enforce a law that isn't the law? But the Supreme Court says no. That's what the Fourth Amendment says. It just prohibits unreasonable searches, and it was a mistake to pull him over, but not an unreasonable mistake. And that case coming just 2 days before my criminal procedure exam gave many of my students a panic attack. I had to get right on the email and tell everybody, it's not on the test. Don't worry. But even if it was on the test, it'd be kind of hard to test because it's a little confusing. But that's for next year's class.
Okay. Well, and something that we may discuss again in the future. Pitt Law Professor David Harris, great thanks to you for being with us today and all of the days throughout this very trying year in our country and in our city of Pittsburgh. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you, Paul. Happy holidays to you and your listeners.
Coming up, culture contributor Joe Woes, speaking of holidays, has the story behind your favorite holiday songs. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.